So again, it's designed to be helpful rather than comprehensive. And I hope that Monday you'll be able to generate some questions that will clarify places where there's a difference in what I presented and the way you would have put it based on what you have in your notes. So, any other preliminary issues or questions? Then let's go back to Schoenberger versus Roberts. As I recall, who was telling us about Schoenberger? Maybe we're missing our reporter. What's that? He's one of the fallen soldiers here. Okay. Well, the question we left with was essentially, how did this case, or how did the statute discussed in this case alter the environment that was set up by the previous common law rule? Again, by way of review here, the common law rule said that where the plaintiff has received compensation from a collateral source, the defendant shouldn't be allowed to reduce its liability by pointing out this compensation. We in effect require the defendant to pay the full amount of whatever would otherwise be owing, and then we expect the plaintiff either contractually to be required to pay it back, or if it turns out to be a windfall, better the plaintiff get the windfall than the defendant. So what does this statute, how does this statute change that environment? And therefore, what should the trial judge have done in ruling on the admissibility of evidence that the plaintiff had already received compensation from workers' comp? Anybody? Mr. Breck, go ahead. Well, the statute could have simply said where a plaintiff receives a recovery from workers' comp, when they receive a recovery for an injury for which workers' comp has already paid compensation, then such a person shall reimburse workers' comp whatever has been paid. That would happen in the background. This statute, on the other hand, does more than that. Kim? That's one of the odd things about the statute is that it doesn't suggest, the statute doesn't say the plaintiff should be paid less money by the defendant. In that sense, it retains the common law rule. Yeah. Yeah. Well, but that's the question about the statute. The defendant says, I want to introduce this evidence that the plaintiff's already received this money. And the trial judge looks at the defendant and says, but the common law rule says you can't do that. And the defendant says, but this statute says I can. This statute says that it will be admissible evidence that the plaintiff has received money from workers' comp. However, the statute goes on to say that the plaintiff's recovery should not be reduced by such an amount. What did the trial judge do at that point? what's the historical record here in terms of what the trial judge did. When the defendant says, I want to introduce this evidence, and the plaintiff says, I don't want that evidence in, how did the trial judge rule? Mr. Kim? Yeah, he rejected the evidence. And the defendant says, excuse me, you're a judge. The statute says, admit this evidence. I don't think you have any choice. And the trial judge says, fine, take him to my boss. You know, the plaintiff says, or the defendant says, in effect, I want to see your supervisor. I want to talk to a supervisor here. And sure enough, they go up to the Court of Appeals, and the question for the Court of Appeals is, was the trial judge right in refusing to admit this evidence, or should the trial judge have shut up and done what he was told? And the appellate court's answer is, he did the right thing. There are times when a statute may call for something that is so absurd the legislature could not possibly have wanted what, you know, somebody made a, it was a slip of the pen, or, you know, somebody's word processor went on a little holiday here, and we just don't have anything that makes any sense here. Now, I think the defendant would say there could be a reason. In other words, if the sole reason for introducing this evidence would be to reduce the amount of the award, well, that is not something the legislature wanted. They did not want the amount to be reduced. And again, the trial judge was afraid that it's sort of like saying, I'm putting $100 telling my 8-year-old, you know, here's $100, put it in your pocket, but don't spend it. That's kind of a dumb idea. You know, either give it to him with the expectation he's going to spend it, or don't give it to him. But to tell the jury, here's this evidence, but don't do anything with it, seems like an invitation for a mistake. But what reason could there be for the legislature to think that this evidence should be admissible? Even if their expectation is that the jury will get it right, they have perhaps a greater degree of confidence in the jury's ability to follow directions. Why might the legislature think it appropriate? Or perhaps, put it more strongly, why would the defendant care? Assuming the defendant had some other motive than the hope that the jury would get confused and deduct this, despite the instructions, even if they were agreeable to, you know, 20-point type of an instruction to the jury, do not use this evidence to reduce the plaintiff's award, what other reason might the defendant be happy to have the jury know about this compensation, just from a practical standpoint? How is that going to change the way the jury looks at the case? Ms. Katsuela? Precisely, that's one of the reasons, precisely. To the extent that there's this kind of magnetic attraction there, that the jury is going to look at this poor, you know, injured person and worry where their next meal is coming from, or, you know, how they're going to support their family or get their medical bills paid for. Once you find it, oh, he's got workers' comp to fall back on, then that sort of magnetic attraction is considerably weakened. It doesn't mean that's the only issue the jury cares about. They're obviously going to care a lot about the underlying liability question. Was the defendant negligent? Did the defendant's negligence cause the plaintiff's injury? But to the extent you have a close case where you're kind of teetering on the edge, knowing that you stand between the plaintiff and hunger or, you know, whatever, may influence some people, at least, to decide erring on the side of the plaintiff. Whereas if they find out the plaintiff's taken care of in terms of compensation, for medical bills and wages, the jury may then feel free to call the liability issue in a more kind of cold-blooded way. So the defendant would really be happy with that development. There's another advantage the defendant would hope to gain from evidence about the workers' comp payments. In addition to the fact of compensation, what else is good about this? Mr. Brad? Well, that would help the plaintiff. I mean, the plaintiff might say, hey, this shows I really was injured. The plaintiff, as it turns out, can still get the advantage of that by introducing the evidence of the cost of the medical care. So to the extent that there is evidence that it costs $6,400 to treat the plaintiff's injury, that helps to verify that there's a real injury there. Yeah. Right, it's the amount that we're talking about. So the plaintiff in a typical personal injury case is asking for a more robust level of compensation, pain and suffering, you know, future wage loss. We're going to massage these numbers to get it to the most favorable level. Workers' comp, by contrast, says nothing about pain and suffering, has no provision for that, only provides medical payments and wage loss, and even those can be restricted to some kind of statutory formula. So to the extent that this is called workers' compensation, that these amounts are treated by the state as though this compensated the plaintiff, that helps to set the right order of magnitude that we should be talking about. Workers' comp paid out $17,800 on this claim. The plaintiff's asking you for $125,000. So again, I really like the fact that this evidence is coming in if I'm the defendant. Would that be a legitimate reason for the legislature to allow such evidence to be admitted? The majority thought no. They don't really address this. They basically say, ordinarily as judges, we shut up and do what we're told. But, you know, every once in a while, you come across these cases where literally following what the legislature wants you to do would result in an absurdity. You know, it's like reading instructions from your spouse who says, you know, do this, make sure you do this, and you say to yourself, gee, I want to make this person happy, but I don't think he or she meant to say this. I would be crazy to literally follow this. There must be a word missing here. Or, you know, she must have meant Bill when she said Paul. So literally following this isn't going to fulfill what I believe to be the intention of the legislature. Now, obviously that's subject to the potential for rationalization. So that if I have teenagers and I tell my teenagers, we're going out tonight, you can have your friends over, but please stay out of the liquor cabinet. And after I leave, my children sit around with their friends and say, now, what did my parents really want? Suppose, for example, somebody showed up at the door with a gun and said, I need some liquor, quick. Would it be okay for me to go into the liquor cabinet? I think so. Why? Because the bigger purpose here was so that I could be happy, you know? Now, they don't understand the importance of alcohol in a young person's life, you know, so they don't see the value of being able to go into the liquor cabinet and share the what I find there with my friends, but I'm sure that's what they really want, you know? I mean, there is... It is so easy to rationalize something by extrapolating from the level of specificity to some more general pronouncement and then coming back and saying, see, I'm not being disobedient here. I'm just being a little more sophisticated in my reading of this. So again, part of the difference between the majority and the dissent is that the majority is believing that it is being more faithful to the legislature's grand purposes, and the dissent says, in effect, that is not for us to decide. We have to shut up and do what we're told. And I like this case. I'm not endorsing the majority opinion by any stretch here, but I like presenting it here because you get a nice little vignette of two different approaches to interpretation here. And it's an issue about which I suspect none of us care. That is, I don't really care what they do about the workers' comp thing. I do care desperately about some other issues where judges look at statutes or constitutions or whatever, and then they have to make a decision. And the question is, at what level of generality do we permit these provisions to be interpreted, and to what extent do you say, shut up and do what you're told? Yours is not the reason why, just do it. And I suspect for different kinds of situations, different people have, it appeals to them in different ways. So again, as you look at what is it a judge is supposed to do? Is the judge supposed to turn off that kind of critical function of imagining what the legislature or the authors of something would have wanted and look woodenly at the text? To what extent is that a protection against willfulness by the court? So again, a larger issue about judicial interpretation, which again we come back to in I'll give you another example that we come to later on. In the medical malpractice section, there is a statute of limitations in Washington that says that the statute of limitations will begin to run against a child if the parents know or should have known of the child's injury. Essentially, instead of having this tolling period throughout the child's minority until the child becomes an adult, that's when the statute of limitations historically begins to run. The medical malpractice reform statute says no, the statute will begin to run when the parents know about the child's injury. And when the Supreme Court got this, they said, well, I don't think that's what the legislature wanted. And said, "This we don't read this as overturning what it says elsewhere in our statutes about the cause of action being told during a person's legal disability." And again, we'll read some more cases on that point later on, Chapter 7, on statute of limitation. How do you go about discerning these principles? Okay, I want to finish here. We can actually finish Chapter 3 today with these last two cases on what I call the scope of acceptable argument. And again, this kind of returns us to the larger question about when we present these cases to the jury, to what extent do we want the plaintiff's lawyers to have a free hand in presenting the case in its most appealing fashion, and to what extent do we fear that turning the plaintiff's lawyers loose results in a kind of distorted perception, and that we need to kind of, we've got this problem of runaway verdicts, and we've got to do something about it. And the first case we have, this Botta versus Brunner, isn't really a case so much, at least as presented to you. It's not a majority opinion ruling on an issue on appeal. It's more a discussion of the process and of this type of argument, and the bottom line in terms of the way jurisdictions handle this is to say, you know, they're basically split. Some permit the argument, some exclude the argument. And this is the kind of argument, as Melvin Belli, an old kind of early Jerry Spence model, or I don't know who would have replaced him as the king of torts, but Melvin Belli was both sort of bragging and also evangelizing for the use of this technique, that instead of going to a jury and saying, my client's been really, really badly injured, I want you to give my client $2 million. It's better to put it in more user-friendly or bite-sized terms, that you say to the jury, for example, to take a case that I actually worked on kind of peripherally, I represented the landlord of a building that was being they were putting a new roof on it. It was a flat roof, and there was this kind of aluminized paint or coating of some kind that was sprayed on the roof to kind of provide a uniform, you know, water barrier, so on. Anyway, the way they did it was it was like a 2 or 3 story building, and the contractor's employee, for this roofing contractor's employee, would drive this truck up, and the truck was full of this coating stuff in a big tank, and it was pumped up to the roof, and then he had a kind of spray wand, kind of like what you have in a self-service car wash, except it was this coating coming out. And he would start at one, you know, side of the roof and just sort of spray his way across and literally paint himself into a corner, you know, and then he'd figure out some way to get off the building. I don't know exactly how it went from there, but in any event, he was concentrating on, you know, creating this even thing. And what he didn't realize was at the corner of the building, the electrical wire had, the poles had lost their original position, and the line sagged as it crossed over the corner of this building. So as he's walking back to the corner, it catches him right in the back of the neck. And as you may know, a lot of the wires that you see, particularly running down the street from pole to pole, the line that comes into your house is a big, thick wire, insulated. It's not a good idea to touch it, but it is insulated, like your cord. But the wires running from the top of the poles down the street are typically uninsulated, or as the lawyer for what was in Washington Water Power would say, they're insulated by air. Remember being corrected one time. I said, no, this wire was uninsulated. He said, no, it was insulated. And I said, what? He said, insulated by air. Okay. But in any event, there's this wire. It's a bare wire. And the way the electricity works is, I mean, it passed from his neck. He was holding this metal wand with this aluminized paint. The electricity runs through his hands down the thing to the truck and starts a fire in the truck. So he gets a pretty good zap when he hits this wire. And the worst injury he has is to his hands, because where his hands are grasping this metal thing and the electricity is running through him, his hands are just basically sort of fused to this metal wand that he's holding. And so the plaintiff's lawyer did what's called a day in the life of the plaintiff and would walk through, in effect, take early days of video then, taking a video of watching this guy go through his day. you know, getting up in the morning, reaching up to get a box of cereal, you know, sort of fumbling with his fingers that what was left of them, you know, getting dressed, trying to button his shirt, zip up his pants. I don't forget how much of that they actually provided, but you get the idea here that just the daily thing of trying to work with these, and then walking through and having people just their attention drawn to his disfigured hand. Now, what Melvin Belli says, in effect, is I want you to think about just one day, or better yet, just an hour of being in the plaintiff's situation. How much is that deserved by way of compensation? $40? Is $40 too much to ask? You go out to have a pleasant dinner someplace. You might pay $40 for a dinner that lasts an hour and 20 minutes. Is it too much to say $40 is compensation for having the kinds of, you know, experiences of the pain, the suffering, the disfigurement, the humiliation, so forth? Okay. Maybe 40, maybe it should be 30, I don't know. But let's look at what that means. You'd then take $30 an hour for the next 57 years, and you're looking at a very big sum of money. But it's only $28 an hour. Or $340 a day, or whatever, you know, however you crunch the numbers. And the defendant says, no, you can't do that. And the defendant's argument is, in effect, well, there's no evidence for this. And the plaintiff says, I know, that's why I'm trying to give you a little mental picture of this. And the plaintiff says, I can ask the jury for $17 trillion, can't I? And the defendant would say, yeah. I mean, I don't think the jury's going to give you $17 trillion. But it's not like we say you can only ask for this amount. You can ask for as much as you want. Well, then why can't I just kind of do the math for the jury? Why not? What justification can the defendant say that arguing about a per diem or even an hourly breakdown of an award is misleading to the jury? Whereas if I tell the jury, I describe all these injuries, I show how he's going to be stuck with this for the next 57 years, and I ask them for a gazillion dollars, I won't be stopped from doing that. Why will I be stopped from asking for $35 an hour? Anybody? Yeah. But you won't stop me from asking for $17 gazillion. Why will you stop me from asking for $35 an hour? Well, then I'm erring on the side of sold out too cheap. I assume the defendant's objecting to this because, as Melvin Belli brags and evangelizes, you'll get a lot more money this way. And in fact, I will. So is that, why is it that I'll get more money that way? Why is it that we shrink from $17 gazillion, but when you put it, it's only $38 an hour? That doesn't sound so bad. Maybe I won't go as high as 38. Maybe it's only 27. I don't know, 19. But I'm thinking in a different order of magnitude than if I were simply asked how much in gross should you pay for this. What's deceptive about this? The defendant's argument would be, in effect, no, this is deceptive because the plaintiff will get used to it. And when we think about most events in life, both events that are good and events that are bad, they have their greatest impact initially, and then they sort of taper off. I mean, we hope our relationships are not like that. Yeah, my kid was kind of fun when he was little, but, you know, been there, done that. You know, you hope that, in fact, relationships get deeper and better and so forth. But in terms of other kinds of experiences, you know, the first ice cream cone, in fact, the first bite of the ice cream cone is great. You know, I'm getting near the end of the cone, I'm still enjoying it, but it wasn't quite like that first slurp of the ice cream cone. And if I went ahead and bought a second and a third and a fourth ice cream cone, there would be this kind of declining impact. And similar to the defendant would argue, the first day you wake up and you realize, gee, I can't move my fingers or, you know, whatever. But after a while, you get used to it. Now, the plaintiff would say, in effect, okay, I make my argument. You make your argument to the jury. Go right up there, Mr. Boyer. You tell the jury, don't buy this malarkey from the plaintiff about this $38 an hour. He's going to get used to it. I want to be there to watch this. And so what the defendant says, in effect, is, you know, I can't make that argument. It's sort of like, I think the rule used to be in football games that if one side lost their, you know, headphone connection to the offensive coordinator up in the skybox, the other guys had to take off their headphones too, because you didn't want this, you know, one team having an advantage over the other. If the defendant cannot make the argument that the plaintiff will get used to it, sure, it looks grisly now, but after a while, it'll be old hat. You know, we know that the defendant could never make that argument, and so what we say is, okay, then plaintiff, you can't make an argument that would, in effect, call for that response when we know the response can't be given. This is where you can see, again, the jurisdictions have split between those who say, hey, it's an argument. Plaintiff's lawyers get to make all sorts of arguments that, you know, they can sing the Star Spangled Banner if they want to. Whatever they think is the most effective way to communicate their message to the jury. And this is not any farther off the beaten track than other kinds of arguments we allow them to make, so it's fair game. And the fact that the defendant doesn't have a good comeback is no good reason, or doesn't want to use the argument they claim might otherwise be appropriate, well, that's just their tough luck. Whereas, again, some jurisdictions say, no, no, this is really getting, again, this mischaracterizes it by looking at a narrow slice. We imagine, oh, gee, how awful it would be to be in that situation. And in fact, awful it is for a period of time, but over time, people do get used to it. Interesting. Hard to tell whether this is really something that deserves a prohibition or something where you say it's fair game. I want to get to the second kind of argument here, which is in Jewett versus Deutsch. And it goes to this argument that what the jury should do in their verdict is send a message to the defendant. And there's an important distinction between civil cases and, I mean, between compensatory cases and punitive damages cases. Where you have a punitive damages case, it's perfectly legitimate for the plaintiff to invite the jury to send a message, because that's what punitive damages are all about. But in theory, in a compensatory case, the measure of damages is not how much do we disapprove of the defendant's conduct, it's simply how much was the plaintiff injured. And it would be a mistake to invite the jury to base their award on communicating a message of disapproval about the defendant. But there's a problem. And that is that without using the term send a message, I can, in effect, invite the jury to send a message. Because if I'm a good plaintiff's lawyer, I'm going to cast the case as a kind of titanic struggle between the forces of good and the forces of evil. There are the forces of compassion who actually care about their fellow human beings, and then there are people to whom other people are just a line on a budget someplace. Namely, the defendant sitting over there. So that a defendant in a typical case is trying to convince the jury, oh, sure, it'd be nice to do that, but, you know, we can't afford it. It doesn't make economic sense for us to have, you know, all of these things. I just got a phone call before I came down here from a reporter from the National Law Journal asking about a case that was just decided, I think it was in Tacoma, but there was a jury verdict just returned in a beating case in which four troubled kids in foster care for the Department of Social and Health Services had savagely beaten this, I think the kid was from Somalia, actually. And the jury awarded $10.5 million in compensation against the state. And the state was essentially saying, this is an impossible task. You know, we have these kids in our care, you know, we don't have the resources to provide them. Well, yeah, sure, we'd like to provide them with all the drug counseling. We'd like to have a, you know, somebody who would accompany them to all of their activities and so forth and so on. We just don't have the resources. It is unreasonable to expect. So to the extent that the standard is that of reasonable care, and the defendant's argument is to say, a reasonable person wouldn't take the precautions the plaintiff says I should have been taking. And the plaintiff then jumps up and says, see, they don't get it. Ladies and gentlemen, through your verdict, you can help them get it. Did I ever say you're supposed to send a message? No. But again, if I'm casting the case in such a way that these two alternatives are presented. One is to say this is an acceptable kind of risk. Stuff like this just happens. The other alternative is to say, no, we've got to do better than that. Many jurors will feel they've been, you know, watching a Mel Gibson movie and, you know, it's Braveheart or it's, you know, The Patriot or something, and, you know, it's time for virtue to triumph over wickedness. Another famous case is the Pennzoil case. Joe Gemayel, who was successful in persuading a jury that Texaco had breached its handshake agreement with Pennzoil, and that in fact there was a deal. And Texaco didn't quite understand that a handshake was a, you know, $10 billion deal. I mean, we're getting there, but until the paperwork is done, we don't have a deal yet. And so the way Joe Gemayel presented this to the jury was, in effect, while out there in New York City, they say, you don't have a deal till your lawyers do it all. But I say here in Texas, when I hold out my hand and I say, we got a deal, don't we? We got a deal. If that's the invitation of the jury to say, in effect, our values versus their values, how does the defendant, again, Texaco was kind of blindsided by this. They said, but you don't really think that these big, huge corporations are going to go, it's not a set from the Dallas, you know, soap opera here. This is like real life, folks. This is business. And again, if the plaintiff's lawyer has the opportunity and can think about it, can plan the case in such a way that it pits the forces of compassion and enlightenment against the forces of bottom line corporate money making, there are likely to be a number of jurors who want to, you know, get up on their chairs and point the finger in the defendant's face and say, you have to do better than that. And again, what the defendants would say is, this is no longer a system of law. This is a system of, you know, it's the Jerry Springer show we've got here. And again, it fuels the whole sense that the tort system has spun out of control. But if you're a plaintiff's lawyer and you deal with injured people, I mean, listen to the late night TV ads or the ads on the radio, you know, for 1-800 Tassel Loafer or whatever it is. You know, the appeal is, I'm the advocate of the, you know, injured person against these faceless, heartless corporations and insurance companies. I'll be your advocate in a world where nobody else cares about you. Who's not going to respond to that? But again, to the extent that the legal system is designed to squeeze some of the passion out of this and put it more on the footing of reasoned deliberation, the defendants keep wanting to say time out. This is not what we set the system up to be. And I don't really have an answer for you from the standpoint that you can tell the plaintiff's lawyer, you may not use the phrase send a message, but what's to prevent Joe Jamail from putting the case to the jury in that way? And maybe the law is against him, but to the extent that the law incorporates a finding of fact by jurors, and jurors are moved by this larger sense that there's a cause to be fought for. I mean, I'd much rather have the plaintiff's end of that than be on the defendant's side. I think it does suggest, notwithstanding all of that, that if you are a defense lawyer, and you manage at least to communicate that you have some moral gravity, that you're not just a faceless corporation. I mean, I would assume that in hindsight, Texaco, knowing what they know now, would have played their hand differently against Joe Jamail and would have tried to say to people, you know, would have gotten down to, on his level and duked it out with him. Whereas if your orientation is more to kind of fight it on a technical level, to appeal to people's rationality instead of appealing at some level to their passion, you're going to be completely outgunned. Because most people at some level are moved by their passions. They want to live in a world of moral right and wrong. They want to fight for the good guy against the bad guy. And so somehow the defendant has to, you know, sometimes the defendant has the advantage of saying, in effect, the alternative scenario is we've got these blood-sucking, you know, vampires over here that are ripping off the system, cynically exploiting it, lying through their teeth, malingering, faking. We got the surveillance video. Look at this, ladies and gentlemen. Then I can get some moral passion going the other way, but that's a rare luxury. Most of the time, it's simply, again, this kind of mismatch. So, again, I don't have an answer for it, but you have, I hope, in the back of your mind, the way in which large personal injury cases require proof of the technicalities But if you're presenting these cases either for the plaintiff or for the defendant, you're looking for a larger canvas on which to paint the case and to present it in a way that's going to move people, make them passionate about your case. And combining this, you know, reason, got to use reason to appeal to the judge, but use this passion to actually influence how people feel about things, that's a pretty scary proposition when you're on the defense side. Anyway, we'll again pick up. Have a happy Thanksgiving. We'll pick up on Monday. Again, please bring questions for our review.
Then things get worse.
Yeah, because say if you